Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of the Why Not podcast. I'm your host, Luis Fernando Correa, and I'm joined today by Lucas Quezado, as usual, but also by one of the most famous names in the world of wine, Mr. Philippe Guigal from the prestigious Rhone Valley Maison Guigal. Philippe is now the owner and the winemaker at the Maison, and for us, it's a tremendous pleasure to have you on the show today, Philippe. Thank you very much for joining and welcome.
Thank you very much. The pleasure is shared, and I'm so glad to spend a little time with you.
Fantastic. Philippe, why don't we start with a brief introduction about yourself and also the Maison, of course.
Well, talking about the winery, the Guigal Estate is a family-owned business, 100% family-owned business, founded by my grandfather, Etienne, the 1st of January, 1946. It's a very interesting date to me simply because a lot of people that I meet, that is to say young generation of sommelier, young generation of professionals, they come to me and they say, you're Mr. Guigal, so you're probably the 10th or the 12th generation of Guigal and Côte Rôtie, which is completely wrong. I represent the third generation. And I used to say that we have always counterbalanced our youth by a very strong dynamism. In a region that we've trusted in for many, many years, that is to say, since the beginning of the winery. So we're young and we're very focused. So we're focused in Rhone wines only. There are temptations, of course, and maybe we'll have opportunities to talk about them. But let's say the Rhone is our specialty since the foundation of the winery, and we're very focused in what we do. I joined the winery... Oh my gosh. I would like to say recently, but time flies. So yeah. some 27 years ago.
Fantastic. And can you tell us a little bit about some of the great milestones in the history of the winery since your grandfather Etienne started? We will, of course, talk about the Lalas, which is, you know, a staple in the world of fine wine. And I'm sure that will be a milestone. But if you could take us through some of the main moments in the winery so far, it would be great.
Yes, with pleasure. So my dad joined the winery in 1961. So he was extremely young when he joined the winery. He was 17 years old. Mm-hmm. He joined in difficult circumstances because my grandfather became blind extremely quickly. So, you know, my grandfather had his head, but my father was more or less his hands and his legs. So they've worked as a duet for many years. And so this is 1961, and they had the great idea to buy a vineyard in 1966, this vineyard being La Mouline. So okay. The first vintage of La Mouline is 1966, and it's one of the very first vineyards that we owned. I got born in 1975, January 1975, and it's the date that my father chose to plant himself the vineyard of La Londonne. Mm-hmm. So we're like twin brothers with the London. We're exactly the same age with the vines. And the first vintage of the London that people know is 1978. La Turque is a Renaissance. So it was a vineyard that was cultivated before 1935. And there's been a gap of 50 years since the time we restarted to produce the first vintage of La Turque in 1985. Following on the milestones of the winery, I would mention the purchase of the Château d'Ampuy, which is the image of our winery today, in 1995, so quite recently. Very important things happening in terms of vineyards in 2001, with the purchase of different wineries, giving us the opportunity to have our own vineyards in Hermitage, have our own vineyards in Saint-Joseph, in Crozes-Hermitage. This is the purchase of Jean-Louis Grippa estate in Saint-Joseph and Hermitage and De Valois. Yeah. And 2003 was another step. We started our own cooperage. So we are the only example in the Rhone Valley of a winery owning its cooperage. And I would, of course, finish with the purchase of the Château de Nalice in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. So we bought an outstanding property of 75 hectares in the best towers of Châteauneuf-du-Pape in July 2017. So this is quite recent.
Fantastic. And I think that there's just so much that I want to ask around this because Starting with the cooperage, what did it allow you to do as a business and as a winery to integrate and to have your own cooperage?
Very clearly, when we launched the first vintage of La Mouline in 1966, people were impressed by the wines, but they were also very surprised by our wish to age this high-end wine in new oak barrels during 3 years and a half. And, you know, a lot of people were surprised or shocked by this move. It's linked to the fact that collecting very old books, talking about winemaking and wine aging of the Rhone Valley, you can read in these books that 202 or 250 years ago, the first growth, there's no more first growth today, but the first growth of Cotentin at the time were aged during between three and 4 years in New York barrels. So the idea of my grandfather and my father at the time has simply been to, let's say, reintroduce a tradition practice in the area. And of course, when you have a stamp or an image with a long-term oak barrel aging, I think it's very important to have a true knowledge of what you buy, what you do, and how you handle your barrels. So we have a bit more than 5,000 barrels at the winery, and we decided to start our own cooperage, not to sell barrels outside. We're extremely selfish, so we keep everything for ourselves.
Keep them all.
Absolutely. But we are extremely focused in... let's say what kind of oak tree we want to cut, at what age, how long we want to dry the staves, how we're going to toast the staves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're very precise on this quality work. And of course, we've been learning during all these years because you know, we're not coopers originally, but after a bit more than 15 years, we start to have a very precise analysis of what we want, and more important, what we don't want.
Yeah, exactly. And this discussion, it's interesting when you bring up, you know, going back to the history books of the region, because one of the things that we, when we read about the Rhone Valley, is a little bit of a shift or a dichotomy between traditionalists and modernists. It's something that we've seen in other regions. I think, you know, Piemonte also has the same discussion around Barolo and et cetera. How do you see the situation in the Rhone now? Is it more dominated by modernists, traditionalists? And where do you see yourselves in this spectrum between, you know, modernists and traditionalists?
My answer is a very clear answer. Both. Both, because I would consider that most people see us as a very classical winery, and they're totally right. That is to say, this use of long-term oak barrels, etc., is something that is extremely traditional in the era. It's been forgotten after World War II, but we reintroduced new oak in the era in the 60s. It was a debate at the time. It's no more a debate. Now, every top winery in the Rhone has more or less new oak, but use new oak. So let's say Bordeaux, Burgundy, Rhone are more or less the same vision on this. I would say that the proper word for the Rhone Valley is the Renaissance word. Because keep in mind that Cotroti is a place where we grow grapes and make wines for the past 2,400 years. Yeah. So we have a tremendous history and very, very deep roots. But of course, most of the things have almost disappeared between the Philoxera crisis and World War II. Yeah. So... back to Cotroti, we're talking about a vineyard in 1946, for example, when my grandfather started, of 40, 45 hectares. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very tiny vineyard. When I talk about 319 hectares nowadays, I'm extremely smiley and very proud because the vineyard has been replanted. We have a lot of young talents. We have a lot of young winemakers. People have rediscovered the Rhone Valley. You know, I always remember the 80s, where many international wine writers at the time were writing beautiful books about the wines of France. Half of the book was about Bordeaux. Yeah. One third was about Burgundy. There were some pages with Alsace, and we had one or two pages for the Rhône Valley. That was almost nothing. And these people were just forgetting the second largest wine producing era in France today. So it was probably a big mistake at the time. Less and less people do this kind of mistake today.
Absolutely, and rightfully so. I mean, in the last few years, just how much the Rhône and Côte Rôtie in particular, you know, the amount of amazing wines that you guys have produced is just outstanding. And I became recently a fan of Syrah, the Northern Rhône Syrah, to be more precise, because of the guy that's on the call as well, because of Luca. And he's a great fan of the region, great fan of your wines, and he got me hooked. So I definitely see, you know, in my book of great French wine, the proportion would probably be inverse, and I would have a lot more pages on the Rhône than Bordeaux.
Thank you.
And Philippe, speaking about fantastic wines, can you give us a little bit, you know, as one of the fathers of the children of the Lalas, can you give us a comparison, you know, La Mouline, La Landon, La Touque, how they are different, what are their intrinsic characteristics?
We're talking about micro terroirs. So these wines are three single vineyards. If we were in Burgundy, we would call them monopoles. And they are extremely interesting because exactly like in Burgundy, they are not too far away, but the expression of the Syrah on these three terroirs, and by terroirs, I mean not only the soil and the subsoil like everybody hears, but also the climate, the microclimate, the practices, that is to say the grapes, even the grapes, are different for each of the crews. So if we talk about La Mouline, we're talking about a sector in Côte Rôtie that people mention as the Côte Blonde. So first of all, it's important for me to tell you about what is the Côte Blonde, what is the Côte Brune. When we talk about the soils of Côte Rôtie, generally speaking, we talk about schists. So the entire Côte Rôtie appellation relies on schists. But you have the southern part of the appellation, where on the top of the schist, of these schists, you find limestone and silica. And like all winemakers know, Syrah growing on limestone is always an elegant and sophisticated Syrah. Okay?
Yeah.
It is also reinforced by the presence of Viognier, because Côte Rôtie is one of the rare appellations in France where you can mix different grapes, such as white grapes within the red grapes. And I'm talking about Viognier in the King Syrah of Northern Rhône. So we can have up to 20% Viognier in a Côte Rôtie. And La Mouline is probably among the vineyards that has the highest percentage of Viognier, that is to say up to 11%. So the combination of limestone, silica, and Viognier make that La Mouline is an extremely elegant wine. It's an extremely silky wine. It is the wine that shows the most finesse. It's also, by chance, the oldest vineyard in the entire Côte Rôtie appellation. So the average age of the vines is 90 years old.
Oh, wow.
And we still have vines dating back 1893. That is to say, the very first replantations after the
Phylloxera. Yep.
Switching to the other part of the vineyard, that is to say, the Côte Brune, we're talking about schists again, but there are two components that are important in these schists, and I'm talking about iron oxide and manganese. Iron oxide and manganese are two elements that will make the Syrah showing bigger, okay, with more tannin, with more structure. It's something that you find in Bordeaux with the Crasse de Fer in the Médoc. It's something that you find in Australia in the Kunawara with the Terra Rossa, the red stone, the red earth. And each time you find iron oxide and manganese, you talk about a Syrah that has shoulders, that has power. And that has, let's say, an extra polyphenolics, color, tannins, etc.
Tannins, yeah.
So La Turque, geographically speaking, is very close to the Côte Blonde. So it's in the Côte Brune, but the Côte Blonde is just a few meters away, meaning that there's a little touch of Viognier. There's 7% of Viognier in La Turque. And it means that it's a Côte Brune. So there is more power, there is more structure, but it keeps an interesting elegance and an interesting finesse. When I talk about La Landonne, which is the northern of the three, I would never use the word finesse or elegance. Because La Landonne is like a young man with big muscles.
Yeah.
Wines have a lot of structure, a lot of body, and it's very much it's almost a wine for the future. Each time people taste La Landonne, they say, ah, I opened it too early, which is quite true. The first vintage, 1978, is drinking extremely beautifully well today. So you have these three single vineyards, okay, that always that people always think about together, La Mouline, La Turque, La Landonne, La.
Yep.
Which is fine. But because of my technical positions, you know, you don't drink La Landonne first and La Mouline after, because if you start by the muscles and the structure and then you go to the finesse, it's not the best way to taste a lineup of wines. It's probably better to start with the elegance, go with a bit more spices with La Turque, and finish with the strength and the power of La Landonne.
Fantastic. Makes a lot of sense. And it's yeah, and these are amazing wines. I wanted to ask you, go back a little bit to the business side of things, Philippe, because it's a privilege to have, as you mentioned at the beginning, a person with multiple hats in the business there, both as a general manager, owner, and winemaker. That means that you're somewhat in the middle of art in when it comes to winemaking and business, right? And I was wondering if there are any contradicting decisions or conflicting decisions that you need to make in managing this business and reconciling, you know, business decisions with winemaking decisions, or does, you know, do things normally go in the same direction?
I would say when you have technical skills and a technical background like myself, like my dad, like my grandfather, we're technical people. So people in the area used to say, the Gigals always have a little bit of earth, a little bit of mud below their shoes.
Yeah.
So, we're the kind of people to spend time in the vineyards, okay, to be at the winery every day. So it is always the technique that will lead. Sometimes you have to do choices. Sometimes you decide to go for green harvests that are more important than what you should do. It's a technical choice. There will be an economical impact, but it's not the problem. The problem is to produce the best wines possible. So it's probably a nonsense for you know, people that are in the business or in economics listening to me. But we're winemakers, you know.
Yep.
So we're very fortunate that today the Rhone is more and more privileged with more high-end wines and more considered in the market, so that we see prices rising for the Rhone Valley. But originally, and of course at the end, it is techniques that will lead the game.
Right. And connecting to this point, Philippe, what is the driving force behind the acquisitions? Because you mentioned at the beginning of the chat quite a few that have happened in the last few years as milestones of the estate. But what has been the driving force in these acquisitions? Well, what are you trying to add to the business or to the maison?
Very clearly, I've got multiple examples, but you know, the last property we took over, that is to say an Alice in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, exists since the beginning of the 16th century.
Yeah.
And I have to admit that, unfortunately, the last example of Nalis for the past 43 years are not Châteauneuf-du-Pape that would make me dream. That is to say, I am not in line with what was done in the past. It's not a style of wine that is matching with my vision of my quality vision of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. And despite what I'm telling you, we bought this property. And we bought it because we didn't buy a finished quality represented by what the team and what the people were doing at the time. We bought it because of the terroir. The terroir is this crazy French word that is difficult to translate in other languages, but you know, it's the wine is not part of the terroir. The terroir is for the wine, and very important that Nalis is for us a coup de cœur. You know, we've visited this property, we've seen these soils, we've seen, you know, the exposure, we've seen the altitude with all the issue of the global warming, the climate change in Chardonnay-du-Pape, you know, and we fell in love. We fell in love because we are convinced that we have a quality potential at Nalis to produce one of the very best examples of Chardonnay-du-Pape. So, you know, once again, it is what is leading the leading point, the leading obsession. It's an obsession for both my father and I. Is to make the best wines possible.
Perfect. And it, correct me if I'm wrong. Before this acquisition, you were buying grapes to make your Chateauneuf-du-Pape, or did you grow your own grapes down there, or is it now with Chateau Nalis that you are able to grow?
Yes, we had no property in Southern Rhône at all. Interestingly. The first bottling of the Gigal Chateauneuf-du-Pape is dating back the vintage 1942.
Oh, wow.
So if you listen to me carefully, you must think something wrong.
He said, how is that possible?
46, and he's talking about 42. It's just that my grandfather, who was a genius for both my dad and I, already thought at the time that it would be a great idea to age the wines, to mature the wines in the cellars before selling them. That is to say, when he officially opened Gigal in 46, he was selling his first wines from the vintage 1942. So it was not a mistake from me. It was really the case. 1942, since 2017, we've been in Chateauneuf-du-Pape for many, many, many years. We had the contacts, we had the knowledge of, you know, the different soils, the different terroirs of the appellation. And I used to say that our major issue to become owners in Chateauneuf-du-Pape was maybe and probably to find the right spot, the right place to settle. Mm-hmm. But more important, we knew exactly what we didn't want.
Yeah,
Chateauneuf-du-Pape. And of course, it is what you don't want that is available first. So we probably waited 20, 25 years to take over this property. Of course, we didn't know it could have been Nalis, but we were actively searching in Chateauneuf-du-Pape for more than 20 years.
Fantastic. And Philippe, now that we spoke about both Côte-Rôtie and Chateauneuf-du-Pape, so we covered Northern Rhône and Southern Rhône, I think it would be a good moment to give our listeners an overview of the different expressions of Syrah in the valley. Of course, you already mentioned the nuances in Côte-Rôtie with Côte Brune, Côte Blonde. But if we compare more broadly, also considering other appellations where you produce, like Saint-Joseph and all the way down south, how do you contrast the different expressions of Syrah in the valley?
If we talk about the Northern Rhône, so we have 75 hectares of outstanding vines in Northern Rhône. And we're not in every appellation. For example, we don't have any vines in Cornas. We don't have any vines in Saint-Pierre for the whites. But it's important to understand that the Northern Rhône, simply, it will sound like Bordeaux, has a right bank and a left bank. The right bank is a matter of Côte-Rôtie, being the northern, and then Saint-Joseph. Okay, Cornas is a little bit south, and the left bank is Hermitage and Crozes Hermitage. And when you have this in mind, you realize that on the right bank, the exposures are southeast. So without talking about the soils, schist in Côte-Rôtie, but south, we're talking about granite. So there's a lot of granite in Saint-Joseph, for example.
Cornas, yeah.
Exactly. And it's southeast. When you switch to the other side of the Rhône Valley, because of the curves that the river does, it's a south-southwest exposure. So clearly, a Syrah grown in Hermitage cannot taste the same as a Syrah grown just on the other side of the Rhône River in Saint-Joseph. We have the case with the Les Bessards and the Vigne de l'Hospice, for example, in Saint-Joseph, one in front of each other. This is the first element. To answer your question, I would say that Northern Rhône Syrah, generally speaking, our powerful Syrah. So it has the depth of a Syrah, but it keeps a balance and an elegance that you don't find in many places in the world. The balance is the key word for me. You can have an extremely powerful wine, like in Hermitage, for example. Hermitage is a powerful appellation, but the wines are balanced. Okay. Yeah. When I switch to the Southern Rhone, it's a totally different vision of Syrah. A few weeks ago, we've picked the Syrah in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. It was ready extremely early this year, in 2020. Mm-hmm. So we've picked the Syrah before the Grenache. And the Syrah is showing extremely open, okay, rich. Yep. We pick in the south around 14.5% potential alcohol in the south. Okay. In the north, to get the same phenolic ripeness, 13.5 is enough.
Yeah.
So, of course, the climatic conditions are not the same. You know, the geology is not the same. So there are a lot of factors making that, for me, Syrah is truly an international grape, but I will never search for the same thing if it's grown in Northern Rhone, if it's grown in South Africa, if it's grown in the Kunawara or in the Enter Valley. You know, it's a grape that is very much matching with the terroir where it's grown.
Perfect. And you mentioned Hermitage, and I wanted to ask you this. If we look at history of the Rhone Valley and history of French wine, the impression is that Hermitage many years ago was the dominating appellation in the valley, right? Probably, you know, for a good part of the last century. And then, you know, I think it correlates a lot with your own timeline at Guigalle. Côte Rôtie overtook Hermitage and is now considered more prestigious and yielding better, more balanced, more elegant wines. First of all, do you agree with the assessment? And why do you see, to what do you attribute this shift in supremacy in the Rhone between, you know, the shift from Hermitage to Côte Rôtie?
Well, first of all, I'm a Rhone guy. So I'm a Côte Rôtie guy, but I'm also an Hermitage guy.
Yes, absolutely.
So, it's difficult for me to talk about a supremacy of one amongst or against another. Let's say that I see these two appellations extremely differently. Côte Rôtie is extremely fashionable nowadays. Yeah. And I can understand this fashion because the wines of Côte Rôtie have this, you know, this bright expression, this pure expression that a lot of people are searching for nowadays. So it could be an explanation. Another explanation that is quite interesting is linked to the appellation itself. Mm-hmm. Hermitage is a fantastic appellation of around 140, 142 hectares. Okay?
Yeah.
Two colors.
Mm-hmm.
That if we talk about Syrah only, it's 100 hectares.
Mm.
Interestingly, Hermitage 50 years ago was also 100 hectares of Syrah, and 200 years ago it was also 100 hectares of Syrah. So it's an appellation that is extremely constant.
Yeah.
If you're fortunate to be there, you'll stay there. If you're not there, it's very difficult to enter Hermitage.
Yeah.
Côte Rôtie, as I told you, after World War II, was only 40 hectares. Nowadays, it's 319 hectares. So we're reaching the max in Côte Rôtie,
right,
the maximum potential of the appellation. You have a lot of new names. You have a lot of new people, new generations that got interest in Côte Rôtie that have been able to replant. So it's a rebirth, a renaissance, Côte Rôtie once again. And I think this youth brings a lot of dynamism. So I'm not telling that Hermitage is not dynamic. You know, we do fantastic things in Hermitage and things are moving forwards. And in terms of spontaneous notoriety, Hermitage is number one in the Rhone Valley. That is to say, if you stop a French guy in the street and ask him to name one appellation of the Rhone Valley, the first appellation he's going to name is Hermitage.
It's still Hermitage. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it's still number one in the mind of the people. But you're correct, because in the market, in the trend, and in the figures, Côte Rôtie is leading today.
Yeah, and where do you see Côte Rôtie in the next 10 years? Because you already mentioned, you know, probably reaching a ceiling as far as the expansion of planet area, but you also mentioned, you know, up-and-comers and new generations. How do you see the appellation evolving in the future?
I am optimistic and pessimistic at the same time. I am optimistic because we've reached, you know, the max of the appellation. And I think we have a bright future in being more and more precise in what we do with the new plantations, the new terroirs.
Yep.
We're talking about 70 years, 80 years for most of the plantations today. So at the French scale, it's extremely recent. This is the good part for me. Where we should be careful in Côte Rôtie is that 15, 20 years ago, we were looking at the Burgundians saying, oh, the prices in Burgundy are so high. Yeah. After 15 years, we have the same prices that the Burgundy wines were getting 15 years ago. And the trend is to see the pricing going up quickly in Côte Rôtie. It might be surprising or shocking for me as a Gigal to talk about the pricing, but I am convinced that we shouldn't go too high too quickly, because what Burgundy can do is very unique, because Burgundy is extremely small.
Yes.
It's an extremely small surface and it's a small production. Talking about the entire Burgundy, the Rhône Valley is not the same size. The Rhône Valley is a huge production. It's a huge area of production. When I do presentations to people, I remind them that French people don't have a very precise idea of what the Rhône Valley is. That is to say, if you take the entire surface of the vineyard touching the Rhône Valley in the north, which is the famous Beaujolais. So you take the entire surface of Beaujolais. To this figure, you add the entire surface of Burgundy. And to these two figures, you have the entire surface of Alsace. The three together almost equal the Rhône Valley. So the Rhône Valley is huge. It's a big region. Yep. And I think when you're bigger, you should do things being extremely careful. It shouldn't be too quick, or it shouldn't go too far. So we're part of these people saying, no doubt, we have outstanding terroirs. So we should compete in a good way with top Burgundies and top Bordeaux. I have no problem and no issue with this. In terms of pricing, we should be careful. In Bordeaux, it took many years. In Burgundy, it took centuries. In here, you know, we shouldn't be too much in a hurry. It's going to happen, but we have time.
Fantastic. That's great to hear. Yeah, go, Luca.
I think that one question that I have on that, Philippe, it's interesting, because one of the things that we talk sometimes, me and Luis, is that there are so many wines that we would like to try, and we probably are not able to afford at this point in time due to this upwards trend that you were mentioning. And I see that it's great for the region that is not getting too expensive yet, because it gives you the flavor of everything that you can try. It's accessible and it makes a good role for the region. Do you see a challenge in the future when you get to that point? I'm not talking 5-10 years. I'm talking like if at a given point in time you get too close to the close or matching the prices of Bordeaux and Burgundy. What would be the challenge that you see when you get to that point?
The challenge of the Rhône Valley is more or less the challenge of French wines in general. So my vision of French wines is that 40 years ago, the French could produce absolutely everything. The worst wines possible with a very low price. Let's say entry-level wines at an affordable price and, you know, interesting in terms of quality, pricing, etc., and top wines. With the new world, and the new world includes Chile, Argentina, Australia, etc., I think I am convinced that France in general has no future in entry-level wines. We will never be able to beat the pricing of other wine regions where, you know, if I talk about Chile, that you know much better than I do, you know, there is no cryptogamic disease. So, you know, there's a lot of things making that it's easier to produce cheaper wines in these regions. So for me, the future of French wines is in quality. And it's also my vision of the Rhône Valley also. I am very fortunate in the range of the Giga wines to produce the Côte du Rhône. The Côte du Rhône is an extremely important wine because it's an affordable wine that people can enjoy all around the world. We have a strong and reliable market in Brazil with the Côte du Rhône. And, you know, people want to grab this bottle and enjoy, and they don't want to pay a crazy price to get this Côte du Rhône. It is extremely important for me to keep this value for money wine.
Yeah.
There will always be La Mouline, La Turque, La London has, you know, these iconic wines that are expensive in the markets. But I need the Côte du Rhône to stay what it is. I need the Gros Hermitage, you know, to be 100% Syrah wine from the Northern Rhône at a reasonable price. I need the Saint-Joseph to be a more sophisticated Syrah from the north, you know, with all the potential you can see in the Saint-Joseph expression. So I am convinced that the Rhône Valley has issues for the future, but it also has, you know, everything to succeed in an international wine market today.
Perfect. Philippe, I wanted to switch the conversation a little bit to vintages and to the evolution of, you know, climatic conditions in the Rhône, because it's something that we see, you know, people harvesting earlier and earlier. We see fires in California, in Australia. We see a bunch of crazy stuff happening as far as, you know, climatic conditions. How has it been for you guys and for the Valley in terms of, you know, how have the vintages behaved? I know 2018 had a super hot summer. I don't know what 2020 looked like. And I was curious to ask you that as well. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of how the vintages have behaved in the Rhône Valley in the last few years?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I have to confess that in the Rhône Valley, it's exactly like anywhere in the world. The climate change is here. I will have two answers to your question. And once again, I'm not a pessimistic guy, but I will have a Northern Rhône guy answer and a Southern Rhône guy answer. The Northern Rhône guy answer is the following. I'm 45 years old. I remember extremely well when I was 10, the vintage 1985. We're talking about very good vintage, of course, 1985. We've finished the harvest, I would say, around the 10th of October. Okay, and it's a vintage where we have chaptalized because we are in a region where it's totally allowed to chaptalize.
Yeah,
and we've made outstanding wines. It's not the points, but we had to chaptalize because we probably picked grapes which were around 12% potential alcohol, and we've chaptalized 1 degree to get the 13 that you see on the label. These past vintages, and then I'll talk about 18 in particular. These past vintages, we are doing harvests before a date. That is a date that everybody should know, but too many people forget. And this date is the 21st of September. The 21st of September is the equinox.
Yeah.
And in our region, equinox means rainfalls and a change in the weather.
Right.
Before the equinox, it's the summer. After the equinox, it's no more the summer.
Yep.
Before the global warming, we were picking grapes and we were starting the harvest during the equinox.
Yeah.
So not the best because of the water, etc. Or after.
Exactly.
The fact that we pick the grapes before the equinox is for me much better.
Mm-hmm.
And if we talk about, you asked me great vintages, if we talk about 2010, which is a fantastic vintage here, like many places, Bordeaux is very good, Burgundy is very good. We've picked, you know, around the 15th, the 17th of September, And we've picked grapes that were between 13 and 13.5. That is to say, exactly what you see on the label. We don't need to chaptalize anymore in Northern Rhone, which is for me much better. So telling you that it was better before would be a lie or a mistake. I consider that with the global warming, we are right now in a situation where we handle things in a much smoother way than we were doing in the past. In the past, you want to wait, the rot is coming, you have to be careful with the rot, you don't have the potential alcoholic degree, etc. Nowadays, we don't have these issues anymore. So it's hard for me to tell you that it was better before. This is the brain of the Northern Rhone guy. Being the Southern Rhone guy, we have an issue with Châteauneuf-du-Pape. Because when I was 10 years old, the top Châteauneuf-du-Pape were 14, 14.5.
Yeah.
And nowadays, if you want to get the phenolic ripeness, so the tannins being good and ripe, sometimes you have to wait 15, 15.5, 16, 16.5% alcohol. It's normal wines. For me, it's too much alcohol.
And it's, back to the balance, it's another category. Yeah.
Exactly. We're not talking about balanced wines anymore. I told you that I was not a pessimistic guy. That is to say, think of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. 13 different grapes.
Yeah.
Everybody kept the Grenache in mind. A lot of people forgot the secondary or the tertiary grapes, you know?
Yeah.
And I am convinced that the future of Châteauneuf-du-Pape can also depend on the location. I told you that Nalis was quite in altitude. So I am convinced for the balance of the Nalis wines for the future. But not only, this property carries the 13 different grapes of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. On the 13 grapes, you have grapes nobody talks about. And you also have white grapes that people start to think of to blend in the red grapes, in the red wines. You know, in order to bring more freshness, maybe more acidity.
Acidity, yep.
And balance the wine. So I think we have everything. You know, the AOCs, it was a very clever system founded in the 30s and the 60s for most of the classifications. And this is very clever. We have the keys, you know, for the climate change lockers in our hands. It's now the responsibility of the players in Châteauneuf-du-Pape and in Southern Rhone, you know, to balance the wine and to find, you know, the solutions to our problems and to, you know, everybody's reaching these kind of issues. I have a lot of friends in Australia and of course they're struggling in some sectors. There were other sectors, the Eden Valley that was very cold in the past that is becoming more interesting now, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, it's a continuous life through centuries.
Yeah, we were talking to a producer in Australia the other day, and we talked about wines that reached 17 or 17.5% ABV, which is crazy. I mean, this is too much for me to handle. At that point, I kind of start considering vodka instead. But anyways, I wanted to ask you about 2020 as a vintage in particular, because you guys have just harvested. Mm-hmm. What does it look like? I mean, it's been such a challenging year outside the wine world with everything that's happening. What is it like for you guys in the Rhone Valley 2020?
I used to say that in 2020, the world was upside down. We've seen crazy things because of the pandemic. You know, I'm not going to talk about the choices of the different states, of the different countries, etc. Sure. But it's been a little bit crazy worldwide. In France, talking about the major vineyards, everything has been upside down.
Right.
So keep in mind that the harvests have started the 13th of August for Champagne.
Oh, wow.
13th of August.
That's got to be a record.
it's a record. Okay, so they picked first. Then people in Burgundy followed. Okay, then the Northern Rhone followed. And we have ended harvest in Châteauneuf-du-Pape 10 days ago before the rains. So it's been upside down. Okay, the North harvested sooner and earlier than the South. Yep. This being said, we took the decision in the north that we would not push, let's say, the maturity up to 14.5, 15, etc. So we've picked earlier. We've studied the whites at a young moment, so about the 27th of August for some of the reds. And what can I say? The potential alkali degree for 2020 Northern Rhône will be 13.5 for the reds,
okay,
not more than this. So once again, I will be able to produce balanced wines. In the south, we have, let's say, the phenolic ripeness issue. So we've harvested later. We've been able to, you know, have sugars around 14, 14.5 potential alcohol, which is reasonable for me in Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
Yeah.
And something quite crazy was the rainfalls. We suffered less from the drought in the south than last year, for example.
Right.
Whereas in the north, it was a drier vintage this year compared to last year. So once again, everything was upside down in this crazy 2020 vintage.
Makes sense. It's been such a crazy year that I wouldn't expect different. and to wrap it up in terms of vintages, Philippe, you already mentioned a few special ones. You know, 1985 is a classic. You mentioned 2010. What are other special vintages for you? I guess you can say also 78 for Lalandon, your twin brother. But what are other special vintages in the Gigal history?
You know, I love to talk about vintages to be drunk now.
Right.
So I will, of course, say a few words about the younger vintages, the past 10 or 15 vintages. But, you know, when you have the chance or the experience to taste a London 78 or a Turk 85 or a La Mouline 1990, you keep this in mind for a long time. The wines are made at Gigal to be drunk after many years. Okay. Right. So I understand, you know, my American friends that are drinking the wines extremely young and early. I can understand the pleasure you have in doing this, but it's important to know that in our minds, you know, the story and the message we want to give is a long-term aging potential. Back to the top vintages, 85 was a very good one. 89 for Côte Rôtie, 90 for Hermitage. And we have a French expression exception for 1991.
Okay.
So 1991 is a truly outstanding vintage in Côte Rôtie. I've tasted wines in Burgundy and in Bordeaux, and I have to admit it was not great.
Not their finest.
you know, in Northern Rhône, in Côte Rôtie in particular, 1991 was truly outstanding. Yeah. 95 was a great vintage, but with such power and, you know, such tannins that it was not conceivable to drink these wines too early.
Right.
I've got an interesting story about 1999. 1999 is a vintage I was already working at the winery. And it's a vintage that I have chosen on the sorting table. So we're not talking about wine, we're talking about grapes.
Grapes, yeah.
To be served for my wedding.
Oh, wow.
Because I knew by looking at the grapes that we would make truly outstanding wines. So right. 1999 is a very, very special vintage. Okay. It was a warm vintage at the time. Mm-hmm. So at that time, there have been warmer vintages, of course.
Sure.
Then we're talking about 2005. 2003 is unusual. It's a very warm vintage year, but quite balanced in the north. 2005, like 95, was a little bit like this when young.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we're in 2009 and 2010. 2010 being much more, much more classical in terms of the structure of the tannins and the frame of the wines.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what can I say? I'm going to sound a little bit like a producer in Bordeaux, but we have 2015, 2016, 2017, 18, and 19 that are pretty outstanding. Not for the same reasons at all.
Sure.
15, once again, is the power. 16 is extremely typical of the balance we're searching for in Côte Rôtie, between mm-hmm. the acidity, between the fruits, between the expression, the spices of the Syrah. 17, we're just starting to do the blend and think of the 17 at Gigal right now, is a vintage that is extremely, we find the fat tannins that we love in top Syrahs in Northern Rhône. So we have this richness, this fatness, which is good. 18 is what American people call a wow vintage.
Mm.
there's more than everything in 18. There's
fireworks.
More canopy, there's more fruit, there's more alcohol. So it's a superlative vintage, if I may say. Mm. And 19 is quite amazing. It's a vintage that will be extremely seductive.
Yeah.
So for wine collectors, they might think that 2019 is not serious enough, but I trust a lot in the structure of the tannins of 19 to do long-lasting wines. So I'm very confident about the past vintages, which is a good news because of the economics. You know, yeah. It would be very difficult these days to release wines from poor vintages. So I consider ourselves extremely fortunate to have great vintages these days.
Yeah, no, absolutely. With everything that's going on and all the challenges for grape growing, it's absolutely fantastic to see the streak that you guys have in hands. And it's great news for us lovers of good Northern Rhône Syrah. I wanted to ask you, Philippe, what's next for Gigal? What are you planning for the future?
I've had these questions many, many times before. And mm-hmm. for the past 20, 25 years, I used to say we are in the Northern Rhône only. Before going anywhere else, we should go to the south. Yeah. Unfortunately, I cannot give the same answer anymore because we have this outstanding property in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. I am convinced that the Rhône Valley is a wine region where we still have a lot of things to do before going to other places.
Right.
I'm in love with California. So I spend a lot of time. I love, Californian Syrah. Mm-hmm. I'm there. I've got a lot of friends there.
Yeah.
It's very much my taste. I might have visited Australia 18 or 20 times. So I'm very familiar and I've got a lot of friends there.
Yeah.
South Africa, I've never visited yet, but I like the balance of the wines, which I think is interesting. But I'm the third generation only. I am very fortunate to have given birth with my wife to the fourth generation.
Wow. Congratulations.
10 years old only. And I believe that, a step to another place is probably a step that we might conduct together with the fourth generation. But once again, we still have a lot of things to do in the Rhône Valley before moving to other places.
As fans of Cornas, Luke and myself, is that in the cards? Is that something that you guys considered exploring in the future?
I will have a very direct and very honest answer. In Northern Rhône, we always consider an appellation if we are able to produce from our vineyards one of the best wines of the appellation.
Sure.
And the answer to your question is that buying grapes or buying wines from Cornas and producing a Gigal Cornas with the classic Gigal label that you know wouldn't be an issue, but it's not our vision. That is to say, if one day there is a property that is available in Cornas where we would feel able to produce a very high quality Cornas, we would probably consider moving there. You know, it's touching Saint-Joseph and it's also once again a place that we know extremely well, but it's a matter of opportunity. So I'm back to my previous answer about we still have a lot of things to do in the Rhône Valley.
Exactly. Now, looking forward to the moment where you guys find the right patch, the right space in Cornas. And
we're not in a hurry. It's just a matter of finding the right terroir, the right place, and something we feel.
Yeah, like you mentioned for Chateauneuf-du-Pape, it was a bit of a waiting game there until the right opportunity came along. And Philippe, I think just going to the final stretch of the of this great conversation, I wanted to, you mentioned the fourth generation already there. What would you like to leave as a legacy for the next generations of Gigal?
It can only be a legacy. When I think of Gigal, I think of a family winery, but three generations only on the land of 24 centuries. Yeah. So, you know, it's my role today is to make sure that the vineyards, the quality philosophy that my grandfather settled originally at Gigal will be transmitted to my boys, to my kids. So, you know, it's an extremely long-term vision. My dad planted La Landonne in 75. Yeah. People talk about it today. Maybe I've planted vineyards for my kids in 2010 when they were born. Mm-hmm. Nobody's seen anything yet. but who knows, you know?
So I love the tease.
we always think long term. Sure. And of course, it has to match with the personality of the different generations. So yes, my grandfather, my dad, and I are classical people, but you know, we're not old-fashioned people. We like to move. We're dynamic, and we have a clear vision where we want to go.
Right. Right. Fantastic. I think my last question, unless Luca wants to add anything, is, you know, every time we talk about the wine world and we get immersed into the wine world, it's a fascinating world, right? And the lifestyle is just incredible. You know, as we joke that wine doesn't grow in ugly places, so, or isn't produced in ugly places. So I wanted to ask you, you know, a life in winemaking and the position that you're at, what is your most favorite thing about being in the wine business? What do you love the most about your job?
It's going to sound very, very basic, but spending time in the vineyards. Mm-hmm. I will be fortunate to drive my car within 1 or 2 hours and drive to Chateauneuf-du-Pape. I'm going to spend the weekend there because I'm eager to taste the 2020 vintage from the vats. So we still have, you know, the grapes, and it's the end of the fermentation. So I'm going to spend sometimes there this weekend. I'm sure I'm going to walk between 10 and 12 kilometers in the vineyards between the Saturday and the Sunday, spending time understanding what the soil look like, what the exposure is, how the vines are expressing, etc. So it's nice to do it right now because it's a sunny day today. I can do this during the winter exactly the same way because you see other things. And at the end, I think the magic of our work is very much to express what nature's gives you originally. So I'm okay with you've used the word art. I'm okay with the word art because you can give the same colors to three different painters and they will make three different paintings. Yeah. So I'm okay with this word, but we have to stay extremely humble looking at what nature does. And my role is not, you know, to be in front and say, okay, if the wines are tasting fantastic, it's because of my dad and I, etc. We do our best for sure, and we're totally dedicated to what we do. But you know, back to one word, terroir. Terroir is what is the most important for me.
Perfect, fantastic, Luca. Anything to add?
I think that on my side, I had just one last question. I think we're good. But if you were starting today, knowing everything that you know by now, and such an amazing experience that you have, what would you do different?
Not much.
Yeah, that's probably the best answer.
That's a great answer.
No, that's
fantastic. No, great.
My side.
Yeah, from my side as well. I think this has been fantastic. Great conversation. Great to know you, Philippe, and to be in touch. If there's anything else that you want to add, it as a final remark. Otherwise,
the only thing I want to add is that I would like to thank you for the quality of your questions, because I think it gave me the opportunity to tell you more about the Rhône Valley. It is, of course, a great privilege to see you and to exchange with you through, let's say, new technology. But nothing replaces a trip to Côte-Rôtie and to the Northern Rhône Valley or to the Rhône Valley. So
absolutely.
What I deeply hope is that as much people as possible, as much as wine lovers as possible, will take the chance to come to the Rhône Valley and discover our vineyards.
Fantastic. It would be a pleasure. And I hope I can be there soon.
It's an open invitation, you know. If it's not tomorrow because of the COVID, it can be next year, it can be anytime. You're always welcome.
Tá aí, esse foi o nosso papo com Philippe Guigal, um grande nome do mundo do vinho, um cara extremamente simpático, atencioso, com muita coisa interessante para compartilhar. E para a gente aqui do podcast, que é fanzaço de Norte do Rhône, de Syrah, foi um presente bater esse papo com ele. Então, ainda que em português, a gente deixa aqui mais uma vez um muito obrigado ao Philippe e a todo mundo lá na Guigal por essa entrevista. Se vocês gostaram, e eu espero que tenham gostado, compartilhem com seus amigos, curtam a nossa página no Instagram, que é podcastwhynot_oficial, e até a próxima. Saúde!